But this week we'll work with what we have. Okay, Parshas Truma. The topic is, as you see at the top, in the only English on the page, Aron and Keruvim. The Aron is something which we kind of take for granted. Well, of course, it's the box that you put the luchos in. But the truth of the matter is that it's much more complex, and the psukim give us some cause to wonder about whether there was one Aron, whether there were two Aronot. Do they exist simultaneously, consecutively? As we'll see. And then if we get to it, we'll also have a discussion about the Kruvim, the cherubs, which I think people universally believe to be sort of the Cupid image type of thing. But we're going to find out. That's not really clear cut. Right. Yeah. Right. We're a little late on it, but that's when Truma came out. Right. Okay. So taking a look at source Aleph, the initial instruction to create the Aron in our parsha in Truma, Va'asu Aron Atzei Shitim, they shall make an Aron of Atzei Shitim. Shitim is possibly some form of cedar, the Gemara suggests. And there's a nice little debate about where exactly you got cedar wood in the desert, that not being the normal place to grow cedar trees. So that there's a suggestion that Yaakov actually brought cedar down to Egypt and made sure there would be stands of cedar trees, anticipating that when the Jews would leave Egypt, they would need the wood. Yes. They somehow knew that they were supposed to take this with them. Well, they took gold and silver also. But did you want your cedar wood? To build their cedar closet to store your food. So they shall make an Aron of Atzei Shitim, of cedar wood. Amasayim v'chetzi orko, 2.5 amos long. Various opinions as to how long an amma is. We generally follow Moshe Feinstein on a tefach to say that a tefach is 3.6 inches. The tefach is supposed to be a fist, in like the breadth of a fist. So we assume that's 3.6 inches, and there are 6 tefach to an amma. So if you remember your math from the days of helping your children, it's 21.6 inches for an amma. Just short of 2 feet, and if you ask me to do that in metric, my answer is do it yourself. They shall make the Aron of Atzei Shitim 2.5 amos long. So working with the 21.6 number, that makes it somewhere around 53 inches long. Four feet and change. The amma v'chetzi rochbo, an amma and a half by width, the amma v'chetzi komaso, and an amma and a half high. The v'tzipisa oso zahav tahor, you shall coat it with gold, pure gold, mibayez umichut tetzapenu, both from the inside and the outside. So in other words, it's a wood box with layers of gold inside it and layers of gold outside it. So if you look at it in any direction, you're going to see gold. Unless they don't cover like the top part of it, like at the top, you could look straight on and see layers. You'll see gold, wood, gold. But that's the way it's supposed to be constructed. Vasisa alav zer zahav saviv, and a nice little rim of gold around it as well, like an ornamental border. Viatzakta lo arba tabot zahav, you shall make 4 rings of gold for it. V'nasata al arba pa'amosav, and they're going to go on the 4 corners. Ushtei taba'os al tzalo ha'echas, ushtei taba'os al tzalo ha'shenis, 2 rings on each side on the corners. And the idea is, as they explain in the next line, V'asisa badei atzei shitim v'tzipisa osam zahav, you make cedar poles, and those go through the rings, and you carry the Aron with those poles. Granted that we're told that the Aron carried itself, nonetheless, you had them stand there and act as though they're holding the Aron. The Kohanim are the ones who do this. And there was actually a rule that the Badim, these poles, could never leave the Aron. Why that's so is another discussion, but that's not something we're going to get into today. And the Torah tells us there in Pasuk Tet Zayin, I skipped a little bit, V'nasatayel ha'aron eis ha'idus asher etein elecha, you shall place in the Aron the eidus, the testimony that I will give you, meaning the luchos. That's our set of instructions as far as creating the Aron. Then there are the Kruvim, but we'll come back to them. So we have here an Aron made of cedar wood. It's a box, 2.5 amos by 1.5 amos by 1.5 amos. It is coated with gold inside and out. Those are the salient points that we need to remember. If you jump down to source Bet, you find Hashem's instruction to Moshe at the time that they create the second set of luchos, that Moshe creates the second set of luchos. So in between Aleph and Bet, presumably, you had the incident of Chet HaEgel. We discussed that a couple of weeks ago in terms of the chronology and how that works, but that's what I'm going to assume right now, is that the source Aleph was pre-Egel, source Bet is post-Egel. And Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Psal lecha shnei luchos avanim karishonim, form for yourself two tablets of stone like the first. V'chasavti al haluchos es hadavrim asher hayu al haluchos harishonim asher shibarta. I am going to inscribe on the tablets that which was on the first ones that you broke. Nice little reminder there to Moshe. The Gemara wants to know why Hashem reminds Moshe, like Moshe forgot that he broke it, and suggests that it's actually the opposite. It's actually praising Moshe for breaking the luchos. This is God's statement of agreement. Asher, like Ashrei, like something that you approve of, and even Yeyasher Kochacha Sheshibarta, Yasher Koach for breaking the luchos. Be that as it may. You do that with your kid, right? Be prepared for the morning. Go up in the morning to Har Sinai. You shall stand there waiting for me, Hashem says, on the top of the mountain. No one else will go up with you. No one should be on the entire mountain, not even Yoshua going up part way or anything like that. Don't have any of the sheep or the cattle grazing by the mountain. And Moshe does so by Yifsol Shnei Luchos Avanim Karishonim, and you shall form two tablets like the first. I'm sorry, and he did form two tablets of stone like the first. And he woke up in the morning and he went up to Har Sinai, and he took in his hands two tablets of stone. Is there any mention here of an Aron? No. No Aron mentioned. Moshe, make these tablets of stone, write on them what it, and I'm sorry, I'm going to write on them what it was on the first, and be ready and go up to Har Sinai. And Moshe did it. Moshe formed the luchos and he went up to Har Sinai. No mention of an Aron at all. And now we go to source Gimel, which wraps up our Keep Sukkim here. And this is the account that appears in Sefer Devarim. Remember that Sefer Devarim is called Mishneh Torah, the second run through the Torah, because it gives us a digest of what happened first in Shmos Vayikra Bamidbar, but there are key changes, and here's one of those. Ba'es hahi, at that time, Amar Hashem Eli, Moshe says, God told me, Psal lecha shnei luchos avanim karishonim, make for yourself two tablets of stone like the first. Notice that Moshe omits asher shibarta, which you broke, right? Ba'alei Eli hahara, come up to the mountain, come up to me on the mountain, ve'asisa lecha aron eitz, and make for yourself an aron of wood. And I am going to write on the luchos that which was on the first set of luchos that you broke, so it does make it in there. And you shall place them in the aron. So now, Moshe retells the story, and he says, yeah, and God told me to make an aron of wood.
But couldn't he, like, he's taking what happened, and there were, like, you know, two different events. He made them, broke them, make the aron, make them again, and he's just combining it all.
It's possible
that it's not necessarily chronologically perfect, but he's summarizing all the pieces.
Right. So that's one approach to this, is to say, yeah, Moshe's summarizing. I was told back in Truma to make an aron, and I'm throwing that in over here. It's nonetheless very strange that his recording of what Hashem told him to do really does include all of the elements that Hashem told him to do. It's pretty precise. He's not omitting anything. And yet, he also puts the aron here, where it really doesn't belong. Why is Moshe even emphasizing it? You know, it's not as though this is like a needed part of the story. You know, Moshe must mention aron, or else the people are going to say, gee, wait a minute, there's something missing from your story. So why does Moshe feel the need to put this in? Even if he's just borrowing from Truma. Why borrow from Truma? What's his...
To show how important the aron is?
Like maybe.
That it's also a lack of gold mentioned. When there was so much gold mentioned before, there's no
right
mention of gold here at all.
And that's another piece of it. All he says is, make an aron eitz, an aron of wood. And look at the description. It continues in Pasuk Gimel. Va'as aron atzei shitim. And I made an aron of this wood, this shitim wood. And I formed this, the luchos, and he goes on to say, and God wrote on the luchos as he wrote on the first ones, so that Moshe emphasized it, and then again in Pasuk Hey, Va'efen va'ireid min ahar. I turned and descended from the mountain. Va'asimas haluchos baron asher asisi. And I put the luchos in the aron I had made. So Moshe, in this short section, mentions the aron three times. God told me, make one. I made one. I put the luchos in it. For something that didn't even make it into Parashas Kisisa. He's borrowing from Truma. It's a very odd thing that he should do this. So this is something that we need to understand better. There seems to be something of a functional difference between the first mention of the Aron and the second mention of the Aron. If you go back to Source Aleph, part that I jumped over, the part with the Kruvim, take a look, please, at Pasuk Chaf Aleph there. V'nasata es hakapores al ha'aron milamala. You shall place the kapores, that's the lid, on the aron. So you shall place the kapores on the aron above. Ve'el ha'aron titenas ha'idus asher etene lecha. And to the aron you will place this testimony, the luchos. V'no adati lecha sham. That last pasuk in Source Aleph. I will meet with you there. V'dibarti itcha me'al ha'kaporez mi'bein shnei ha'kruvim. Hashem says, I will speak with you from atop the lid of the Aron, between the two kruvim, asher al aron ha'edus, who are on the Aron, eis kol asher ha'tzaveh uschal b'nei Yisrael, all that I will instruct you to tell the Jewish people. So that the first Aron isn't only a box in which to put the luchos, a nice storage thing, like I went to IKEA and I picked up an Aron, but it's also the location where Hashem's presence is going to be manifest when he speaks to Moshe. Whereas the second one doesn't have any mention at all in Source Gimel of Hashem speaking to Moshe on that spot. Not only that, there's no location for the second one. Right? The first one is part of the instructions for building the Mishkan. It's one of the kelim. It's one of the vessels that they're going to have in the Mishkan. The second one is in a vacuum. It's a box for the luchos, wherever the luchos may happen to be, we don't know. But it's a box for the luchos. It doesn't have Mishkan-related existence. It's actually independent. One other note that I feel obliged to mention, because you can't really skip this. If you take a look at Source Dalet, there's a catch here. That's Rashi on the last pasuk from Source Aleph. I brought, but I usually don't do, but I did here, I brought what we call the Dibur HaMaschil. Dibur HaMaschil, Dibur HaMatchil is the opening statement, meaning when Rashi comments on a pasuk, so he first gives you the words from the pasuk on which he's commenting. It's handy. Here, the giveaway for what Rashi is doing is actually in his Dibur HaMaschil. Can you contrast? This requires a little greater Hebrew adeptness, but can you contrast the Dibur HaMaschil that Rashi quotes from the Pasuk in Dalet with the actual words that appear in the Pasuk, which is at the end of Source Aleph?
Is it okay to have?
Yeah. There's no Vav. The opening letter that Rashi has is a Vav. That doesn't appear in the actual pasuk. And take a look at what Rashi does. Hare vav zu yisera utfela, Rashi says. This vav, meaning the vav that he has, ve'es, is extra and subsidiary. V'kamahu harbe b'mikra. There are many like this in the Torah. V'ko tiftar, and this is the way to explain this sentence. Ve'es hashera daberim hasham, that which and that which I will speak with you there by the Aron, Hashem says to Moshe, is kol asher atzaveh uschal b'nei Yisrael hu. That's all that I'm going to command you to tell the Jewish people. In other words, I'm going to meet with you there, and while we're there, I'm going to tell you all the things that you should tell the Jews. Rashi is trying to explain an and that doesn't belong. Meaning, if you read the sentence, go back to source Aleph, the last sentence, the way it reads, as we have it, is, I will meet with you there, and I will speak with you from atop the kaporis, between the kruvim that are on the Aron, all that I will instruct you to tell the Jewish people. That's the way it reads, the way we have it. If you read it with Rashi's Vav, then it's, and I will meet with you there and speak to you from atop the kaparis between the kruvim that are on the Aron and all that I will instruct you to tell the Jewish people. The and doesn't read right. Rashi has a problem. Because in Rashi's Torah, there's a vav.
I was going to say, copy, there's a vav?
In Rashi Sefer Torah that they're reading in Troyes in France, there's a vav. We don't have. And we're not the ones to discover this. Every Mefarish after Rashi's time looks at this and says, Rashi, you know, you have a vav that we don't have. But it raises all sorts of fascinating problems. The theoretical explanation for how this happened is fairly straightforward. You don't have that great a degree of travel and communication from one town to the next. Remember that the end of Rashi's day is the Crusades, but in Rashi's day already, the Jews are having trouble, and it's not safe for you to do a lot of traveling around. It's not as convenient. You're not going to necessarily go someplace and hear Kriyas HaTorah there and say, hey, wait a minute, in ours, back home, it's not quite the same way. You're not going to make that comparison. Today, there's a much greater degree of travel back and forth and resulting error checking that goes on. So it's possible. The sofer is sitting there, and he, by accident, puts in a vav that doesn't belong, and lo and behold, very much so.
It's so careful. Yeah. I thought that...
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Has this come out in other places? Like, is this the only time that somebody making a comment on something that...
We don't have.
Yeah.
Right, so there are two or three. I forget if it's two or three that Rashi has.
That people who are heretics could really have a field day with. I mean,
yes.
It's like a big deal.
Yes. The response to the heretic is exactly the response that you have about the care that people take with it. In other words, the fact that this stands out as an alteration in the 1,000 years since Rashi wrote this says something. The fact of the matter is that our error rate, so to speak, is actually very good in terms of the transmission of a text across cultural boundaries, across continental boundaries, over what's literally been millennia, is actually, we're doing far better than the expected error rate. There are scientific journals on verbal tradition and written traditions and how they're passed down. And when you compare our scrolls with things that are ancient, even going back to the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're doing pretty well. That said, we're not 100%, as evidenced by Rashi with this vav.
But I'm saying this type of thing being public, and if there's other, it's human error, right?
Yeah.
And what you're saying is that it's less. It's still, they would say, here you go, you're interpreting every letter and every sign and whatever, and look,
Yeah, and it's a problem. It's not, it's one of the reasons why you need to be very careful when you start trying to interpret every letter, because you have to ask yourself, well, wait a minute, am I right?
Is this something that they've written about?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not, it's news from a layman's perspective, this is news, because it's not the sort of thing that people are ordinarily aware of. But for anyone working in it, not just on a secular scholarship level, but in a yeshiva context, it's something that if they're not aware of, there's a flaw in their education. Because the Gemara already tells you that Ezra fixes the Sifrei Torah in his day. Ezra takes three Sifrei Torah and essentially votes among them in order to determine the proper text for the Sefer Torah. That's Ezra HaSofer. Now, the fact that he's doing that tells you that there's a problem going on pre-Ezra that he has to fix. One of the interesting aspects of this, aside from the question of, well, are we analyzing letters and all that, is the philosophical issue. The Rambam tells you that you have to believe that every single letter of your Sefer Torah came from Har Sinai. And nothing has changed. Well, if Rashi believes that regarding his Sefer Torah, right, then Rashi believed incorrectly, because Rashi had a Sefer Torah that actually was wrong by a letter. Right? In other words, the general assumption is that Rashi's text resulted from a sofer in his town who made a mistake. His is not the correct version.
Was every version in his town that way? Did he, check every version?
Rashi.
It's
not surprising that there would be one out there, but that it would be Rashi's and that he didn't know.
Did they ever find the sefer Torah?
Nah. Sefer Torah don't, as a rule, survive this long.
Okay.
They just... Yeah, it's not because of the way they're used and because of the way they're stored. They don't survive centuries and centuries. There are the rare exceptions, but as a general rule, they don't.
So, would people that are interpreting every word and every letter, would they say it's the type of thing like Lo Bashamayim, he applied to this, and you know, this became part of our, like, how would they?
So I asked this question of Rav Noach Weinberg, Alav Shalom, from Eish HaTorah. I asked him about the Torah codes.
Right.
And I said to him, you know that Rashi doesn't have them. That means all his codes are messed up. Like where we're finding Ahmadinejad in the Sefer Torah, which is no small trick. Rashi would have had Ahmadinejad or whatever it is because he has a Vav. So what do you make of that? So his answer was, Hashem gave us the Sefer Torah that he wanted us to have to find that which we are going to find. It's all part of the general plan, which is a variation on an idea proposed by the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish dealt with it in a different context. In Halacha, we generally start with the Shulchan Aruch as a starting point for dealing with new issues. We look back, what does the Shulchan Aruch say? What do the commentaries say? Well, the Shulchan Aruch came to his conclusions based on the tour for him. And those opinions were developed by basically voting among the opinions of the Rishonim, who came before them. Rashba, Rush, sages like that, looking at what they had to say on a given issue and saying, well, we follow this view. And there are rules that they use to figure out who to follow. There are texts from the period of the Rishonim that the Shulchan Aruch didn't have, that we now have. The classic example is the Meiri. The Meiri writing in, I think it was the 15th century, in Provence, was a known sage of his day. He's quoted by his colleagues, but his manuscripts disappear. And they only reappear in the beginning of the 20th century. And so the Chazon Ish was asked, maybe the Shulchan Aruch would have ruled differently if he had the Meiri in front of him. Maybe the Torah would have ruled differently if he had the Meiri in front of him. The Meiri, especially, because the Meiri actually does some things that are unique. He has some very interesting perspectives that don't match what everybody else is doing. So the Chazon Ish's answer was, you work with what you have in front of you. And this is what the Torah had, this is what the Shulchan Aruch had, that's what God wanted them to have at their disposal, and that's what we work with. And we don't now overturn the Shulchan Aruch because we discovered a Rishon. That was his perspective. It's the same idea applied in a different way. But I brought it here because I feel like it's something that people should know. It's not not in order to cause people to question their Sifrei Torah, or the Rambam or Rashi, but because otherwise you end up hearing it from someone who says, "Imagine that your Masorah is all wrong," and that's not good. That's not a good way to learn about Rashi's extra vav. It's just not the way to do it. Yes, Rashi has an extra vav. Yes, the Mefarshim are aware of it other than Rashi himself, and they all comment on it and say, gee, look, there's a mistake there. But realistically, knowing that it doesn't change the meaning of the text, and knowing that this is one of a vanishingly small number of errors over, many, many centuries, doesn't bother me.
The errors?
They tend not to be because we have the error checking systems that we have. In other words, you have someone who's a Baal Kriya in one community who goes to another community and he starts reading from the Torah. I had that when I was in Rhode Island. I leaned every Shabbos, and at one point we got to a parsha and I said, wait, that's just wrong. And it wasn't like something had been scratched out, over time, something got rubbed and no, it wasn't that. It was actually a bona fide error. It was a word like le'ene, and there was a yud missing in it. It just had been written wrong. And that had been used for I don't know how many years before I read it and said, well, that's a mistake. The fact that we use the Sifrei Torah is what has us, that's our system of verification, which is why you're not supposed to not read from a Sefer Torah. Meaning, Sifrei Torah are meant to be read from. One reason is to ventilate them, because it's bad for the parchment if they're not used. But another reason is, in fact, to get a chance to edit and look for mistakes. Ultimately, we're relying on human beings with all the error checking in the world. Granted, now some of the companies that write, they have the Sofer writes Sifrei Torah. They have computers that they use to scan the Sefer to look for errors, and the software is pretty good. I still think they'll probably find some things that get through. It's just the nature of things. Okay, back to our own. We have two different accounts of the Aron. So how do we understand this? Rashi's view is that these are actually two separate Aronot. He does not accept the idea that Moshe is simply merging together Truma with Kisisa to produce his account. It's actually two separate Aronot, and they exist simultaneously. And the way Rashi works it is that building the Mishkan began after Moshe got the second set of Luchos. And Moshe needs an Aron for the second set of Luchos. Because if you remember the way it works, when the instructions are given to build the Mishkan, Moshe tells Bezalel to make the kelim, the implements, before he tells him how to build the Mishkan itself, the walls and the cover. And then Bezalel corrects it and builds the kelim first. He builds the structure first, and then the kelim afterwards. And Moshe says, "Oh, that's a really smart thing to do." Bezalel Kel Ha'isa, that's the play on the name Bezalel. You were in the shadow of God when He instructed me. That's the way it was supposed to be done. So Rashi says Moshe comes down from the mountain and he has luchos that need a box. So he builds a box at Hashem's instruction. That's in Kisisa. Before there is a Mishkan that's going to have its own Aron. And this Aron persists, and they use it when they go out to war, because they are indeed told to take the Luchos out to war with them. So that's what they do. This Aron contains, he says, the broken Luchos.
Which one is this?
This the one that goes out to war with them,
which is
the one that the first one ends up holding instead the broken pieces. No, I'm sorry. The gold one is in the Mishkan. The wood one, that stays there. The wood one goes out to war
with the broken
luchos in it. Even though the wood one is initially built to hold the second set.
Right, okay, so they switch which one gets what.
Apparently. Take a look at Rashi, source A. Bo'ez Hahi. This is on Moshe's statement of how he built it and how he brought down the second set of luchos with the Aron. He says, "Lesof arboim yom nisratza li." After 40 days, Hashem was appeased by me. Va'amar li psal lacha, and He said to me, "Make this for yourself." V'achar kach, and then v'asi psal lacha Aron. Make an Aron for yourself. Vani asisi aron tchila, and Moshe says, "I made the aron first. Shekshe avo valuchos biyadi heichanet neim." Because otherwise, if I'm going to show up and I have luchos in my hands, where am I going to put them while I'm making the aron? So therefore, I planned ahead, a first in male history, and I built the aron. Velozehu ha'aron sha'asa Bezalel. This is not the aron Bezalel made. Shari mishkan lo nisasku bo ad la'acha yom ha'kippurim. They didn't involve themselves in the mishkan until after Yom Kippur. Kibberit atomen ha'har tziva lahem ha'malachas ha'mishkan. Because when he descended from the mountain, he instructed them about the mishkan. Remember, we talked about what the order is on that. U'Bezalel asa mishkan tchila ve'achakach aron ve'kelim. Bezalel made the mishkan structure first, and then the aron and the vessels. Nimtzeh aron acher haya. So this must have been another aron. Vizeu shahaya yotze imam lamalchama. This went to war with them. Va'oso shahasa Bezalel lo yatze lamalchama elevi me Eli. Bezalel's Aron did not go out to war with them, except in the days of Eli. If you remember the story from the beginning of Shmuel, Chafni and Pinchas, Eli's sons, start a war that they're not supposed to start, and they bring the Aron with them to guarantee victory, and the Plishtim end up getting the Aron from them. They lose the Aron, which is a very bad thing to have to go home and tell your parents. So the Nen, Shuala, Venishba, they were punished for taking out the Aron, and it was taken captive, and the whole story there in the beginning of Shmuel. But this Aron then is the war Aron. That's the way that Rashi looks at it. You have an Aron in the Mishkan and an Aron that's not in the Mishkan, which explains why it is that in Parshas Truma, when we're told about the Aron, we're told that's where Hashem will speak to Moshe, right? That's a very Mishkan-centered Aron, whereas this one in Devarim is not mentioned in the context of the Mishkan at all, or as a place where Hashem will speak to him, because it's not. That's not what it is. Where did they store it then? Rashi doesn't say. I would guess in the Mishkan, because where else are you going to put something like this? You don't leave the Luchos lying around. But he doesn't actually say.
Why would he switch which one goes in which? I mean, understandably, like, you can say, okay, the second ones are complete, and they deserve the gold, and whatever, but on what grounds would he do that, you know? Because he was told to put the first set in the gold one, and he was told.
Yeah, so it's a strange thing.
Where do you get that, and right. why do you take the broken ones to war?
Right. So I've actually been trying to figure that out. In other words, as I was reading through here, Rashi doesn't say explicitly that he switched them, that it's the broken ones that are in the other one. The Ramban is going to take it as a given that that's what Rashi is doing, as we'll see when we, in a minute with Ramban. I think, though, the rationale would be that the Luchos are supposed to be in the Mishkan, and the Mishkan one is the gold one. So therefore, the whole ones have to be there, and that only leaves you with the broken ones to put in the other Aron. So he has to do the switch for that reason. And if you view it as utilitarian instruction from God, make sure you have an Aron ready. So it's not as though it has to be these Luchos and this Aron. That's just what he's going to have until the Mishkan is built. Okay. So that's Rashi's view. Ramban, looking at the same evidence as Rashi, but adding in a few sources from the Gemara and the Medrash, says, can't be. He says, rather, it's two Aronot. One, first, when Moshe comes down from the mountain, the wood one. And then, once the Mishkan is built and you have the gold Aron, that one takes over for the first. The first one is gone. And the Luchos, whole and broken, are in the second Aron. Everything is transferred to the second Aron, and that's the permanent Aron. The Ramban quotes Rashi, and he says, come on. He says, that's Divrei Yachid, that's an individual's view, that's not the mainstream view. Take a look, please, at source Vav. V'tam v'asisa lacha Aron 8, the reason for saying, you shall make for yourself an Aron of wood, shetasim aluchos besocho be'ez sheteret, you will put the luchos in it when you descend. V'haya Aron azek kulo 8, who? This Aron was entirely of wood, v'amechsa asher alav milamala keminog b'chol Aronos, and had a cover upon it as well, like with Aronot in general. An Aron fundamentally is a box. That's what it is. Although there was a nice note in Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch about that. The Aron is a temporary receptacle, by definition. He says an Aron is not a place where you store things forever. An Aron is a place where you store things that you are eventually going to remove. And it's very nice because it has a nice association with the use of an Aron as classically used as a casket. And the idea is of Tchias HaMesim, that the body will eventually emerge. Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch makes that point. I thought I might have brought it here, but I actually didn't. All right. In any case, he says, that's an Aron. It's a box with a lid on it. Vayoa luchos shamach nasa mishkan. The luchos were in it until they made the mishkan. Va'az asua aron ha-metsupa zav. Then they made the Aron coated with gold. Va'kapara seshara lav zahav tahor. And the lid on it made of pure gold. V'lo amar lo hin beluchos harishonos. And God didn't tell Moshe about making an Aron with the first set of luchos. Right? You notice that wasn't there. Right? No, there's no mention in Yisro of making Aron. Lefishaya galu lefanav shiyashav reim, because God knew Moshe was going to break them. That's a remarkable statement. That's not a small statement. Right? God didn't bother telling him to make a box because they weren't going to need it.
Still, what are you going to do with broken luchos?
I don't know. Right. We assume that they're kept. It's an interesting point. This doesn't really answer the question of why Moshe isn't told to make a box. You also sort of wonder, wasn't this the hint to Moshe? Aside from the whole free will discussion. It's sort of like when you give your kid a present that you know he's going to break. Like, you know, well, why didn't you get like a backup set of batteries? And the answer is because it won't hold your interest that long. Don't worry.
But for the second luchos, Moshe made the box first. Of his own initiative.
The way he paints it in Devarim Yud is that it's not of his own initiative. Amar Hashem Elai, Hashem told me, V'asiz alecha Aron Eitz. V'tam v'yihyu sham kasher tzivani Hashem, and he says, when Moshe says, the Luchos were then in the Aron as Hashem instructed me, that means, shayu sham ad shenasa mishkan, that they were there until the Mishkan was created. Shet tzivani, that Hashem instructed me, v'nasatas hakafaros ha'aron melamala ve'el ha'aron t'tenes ha'idus asher ateni lecha, in the creation of the Mishkan, you shall have an Aron with a lid, and you should put the Luchos in it. V'zeu atov v'ayashar b'psukim ha'ela, and that, he says, is the right way to read the psukim. That's Ramban's capsule description of the way that the Aron was created and how it worked. He then quotes Rashi, and he explains why he doesn't agree with Rashi that these were simultaneous Aronot. Rather than read the whole thing inside, although I did bring it for you here, it goes on to the second side, I'm going to sum up sort of along the way you can follow as he says it. He first quotes Rashi, and he says, I have a basic problem. He says, if you're reading along, it's V'yesh Lishol in the second paragraph. He says, you could ask, if he took the Luchos, and he put them in Bezalel's Aron, then what was in the second box? Or the second box, which was the first box? Right? According to your view, Rashi, that they kept two boxes, what do they put in? Once you take the whole Luchos and put them in the one in the Mishkan, what's in the other box? So he says, you'll have to say it's the Shivrei Luchos. It's the broken Luchos are sitting in this other box. He says, well, that's actually an individual's view. That's not the mainstream view, because we have a Yerushalmi which says that that brings the view of Rabbi Yehuda, who says that there were, in fact, two Aronot, but the Rabbanan there say that it's not so. Rather, Luchos v'shivrei Luchos munachim ba'aron, that the Luchos and the intact ones and the broken ones were both in the Aron. That's the mainstream view. As a matter of fact, the Gemara uses it to teach a very nice lesson. The Gemara says that you should be careful with a person who was once scholarly, was once learned, and then due to age and senility, whatever, has forgotten his learning. The Gemara says you should be very careful to show that person the respect that you showed them when they were learned, and it learns it from here, because even the broken Luchos get to stay in the Aron. Now, that presupposes one Aron with two sets of Luchos in it. So Ramban says, according to you, you've got two boxes, you have an empty box. You're taking that out to war with nothing in it? I mean, what's the value of a box with nothing in it? The answer may be it keeps the insurance people happy. The one we took out to war didn't have anything in it in the first place. But other than that, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Further, he says, where did you keep this other Aron that you say had the broken Luchos in it? So where did you keep it? It's not as though you have room in the Kodesh Kadashim for a second Aron. He says, that doesn't work. Further, the end of the first side, he says, when Shlomo brings the Aron into the Kodesh Kadashim, as is recorded in Malachim Aleph, it only mentions one Aron. So Ramban says, that's not the way it worked. He says, there was in fact a temporary Aron, and then they got rid of the temporary Aron when they had the new one in the Mishkan. He says, that's the way it worked. As far as the question then of what happens to the first one, once you have the second one, what do you do with an Aron that Moshe built? You auction off on eBay. What exactly did they do with it? So he says, yeah, they hid it away in Geniza, they buried it. Alternatively, he says, there's another possibility, and this is very interesting. Remember the construction of the Aron? What was the Aron for the Mishkan supposed to look like? Oh, we just did it.
Wood gilded with gold.
Right.
So it was the wood one, and this is what they gilded.
Right. Ramban suggests that maybe this was the wood layer around which they put the gold. Which is a very nice idea, I think. And it's elegant. It works out all the problems. But it's also nice. They kept Moshe as Aron, and they just put gold around it.
But didn't it say to build a sacred?
But it implies that there was, like, the pasuk implies that they made it.
Yeah, it does. It could be, this counts as making it, because Moshe made it.
Right.
It also happens to be true that it isn't as though Bezalel made all of the implements. If you look at this week's Toronto Torah that will be out in Shul on Shabbos, you will see a question there. One of the questions in the Parsha questions is, who made the menorah? And the answer is not Bezalel. I won't give any more away. Read it. But the answer is not Bezalel. Someone else makes the menorah. So similarly here, Moshe makes the Aron. It's a nice idea. I like the idea of saving Moshe's Aron, and using it in this way. Two other interesting notes on this. One is a comment that Tosfos makes in Chulin. Tosfos agrees with Rashi that these are simultaneous aronot. He says, though, that the assumption in general in when you read a pasuk is to read it in its most literal way. And to along with that, the assumption is a certain conservation of, not conservation of detail exactly, but conservation of entities. It's sort of like there's the Gemara will occasionally tell you that so-and-so that you read about in one part of Tanakh is the same person as so-and-so in another part of Tanakh. So, for example, the Gemara suggests that Malachi might have been Ezra. And then there's another one that suggests that Mordechai might have been Malachi. It gets a little messy. But there's this conservation of personalities. Like Pinchas is Eliyahu. Things like that. You hear about these in Divrei Torah from time to time. So he suggests as well this principle of conservation of entities. So that when I read about an Aron here, and I read about an Aron there, my knee-jerk assumption is it's the same Aron. My assumption is not that these are two separate Aronot. He does it in terms of a discussion about angels. The Gemara is bothered that in one section it says that the angels had four wings, and in another section it says they had six wings, and the Gemara tries to justify why one says four wings and one says six wings. And the Gemara doesn't give the obvious answer, based on the context, that one is talking about angels called Seraphim, and the other is talking about angels called Chayot, and these are two different entities. The assumption is angels are angels. And the assumption is an Aron is an Aron. And when you see Aron in one place, you see Aron in another place, it's all the same Aron. That's my default assumption. And therefore, we're bothered by seeing this, and that's what generates the whole discussion. One last point. If you take a look back in your Psukim, in Source Aleph, okay? It says, V'asu aron atzei shitim. Right? They shall make an aron of cedar wood. However, if you take a look in source Gimel, you find it, V'asisa lecha aron eitz. You, singular, shall make an aron of wood. So that in Truma, it's they shall make. In Ekev, it's the asisa lecha, you shall make, singular, Moshe. So is it the Jews making it as a population, or is it Moshe making it? So the Gemara in Yuma is bothered by that. And it's source Zion. Abachanan Omer Mishum Rabbi Elazar, Abachanan cites Rabbi Elazar saying, Kasav Echad Omer V'asisa Lecha Aron Eitz. One pasuk says, you, singular, shall make an Aron of wood for yourself. V'kasav Echad Omer V'asu Aron Atzei Shitim. But another one says that they shall make an Aron of cedar wood, of shitim wood. Haketzad, how does that work? Kan bizman she Yisrael osin ritzano shal makom, kan bizman shein osin ritzano shal makom. It depends on what we are doing at the time. Meaning, the original instruction, they shall make, crediting the Jewish people as a whole, the creation of the Aron, is an instruction that's pre-Golden Calf, pre-Egel. And therefore, the Jews as a whole are credited with creating the Aron. Whereas, the source that we have in Ekev is post-Egel, post-Golden Calf. And Hashem says, Moshe, you create the Aron. The Jews as a whole are not going to get credit. When we do what we're supposed to do, then it's a national credit. If we don't do what we're supposed to do, then Moshe personally gets the credit for creating the Aron. That's the idea. Okay. That's the Aron note. We're not going to get to the Kruvim today. So, all right. So,